रहे हो CGSF 90.1 FM, जो कि बर्नबी ब्रिटिश कोलंबिया में स्थित है.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency. On Tuesday, November 5th, I'll be joined by Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and guests from around the country for a live election night special. I hope you'll tune in at democracynow.org from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time for our one-of-a-kind reporting and analysis on this critical election. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have the same shock that you have looking at how the United States is behaving in this context, in the context of the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. It's not that the United States is simply an observer. The United States is being an enabler in what Israel has been doing.
As Israel continues its deadly siege on northern Gaza, we speak to the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, Francesca Albanese. She's come under attack by U.S. and Israeli officials after she accused Israel of genocide. Earlier this week, her briefing to Congress was canceled. She'll join us today in studio. Then we turn to the race for the White House.
I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to protect them from migrants coming in. I'm going to protect them from foreign countries that want to hit us with missiles and lots of other things.
Whether the women liked it or not, I'm going to protect them. Those were the words of Donald Trump on the campaign trail. We'll speak to former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner and the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign in North Carolina. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces killed at least 19 people after launching fresh attacks on Lebanon's ancient city of Baalbek. The strikes on the UNESCO World Heritage City come just hours after tens of thousands of people fled the area after Israel issued forced evacuation orders. Despite the mounting death toll, Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Makati says he hopes a ceasefire deal will be announced in the coming days as U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein arrives in Jerusalem today for more talks. Meanwhile, Hezbollah's new chief, Naim Qassem, said the group is prepared to keep fighting Israel, but that it was open to a ceasefire deal. Qassem, who replaces the assassinated Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, also addressed Israel's war on Gaza.
The people of Gaza have a right over us, and everyone must support them. They have a human right, an Arab right, an Islamic right, a religious right, and a national right. We should not be asking why we supported them. Rather, others should be asked, why didn't you support the people of Gaza?
Human Rights Watch is calling on countries to suspend arms sales to Israel, accusing it of committing war crimes by attacking medical workers and healthcare facilities in Lebanon. As of last week, Israel killed over 160 health and rescue workers across Lebanon and damaged over 150 ambulances and 55 hospitals. Meanwhile, the UN interim force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, says its forces are continuing to come under attack.
Since the 1st of October, UNIFIL has recorded over 30 incidents resulting in damage to UN property or premises or injuring to peacekeepers. About 20 of those we could attribute to IDF fire or actions, with 7 being clearly deliberate.
Israeli forces in northern Gaza have carried out more attacks on Kamel Adwan Hospital, injuring health workers, destroying already scarce medical supplies, water tanks, as well as a nearby water desalination station. In southern Gaza, loved ones grieve 4 relatives who were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Khan Yunis, including a child. This is a neighbor of the victims.
Exactly 3 days ago, the Israeli army declared this area a safe zone and classified it as a humanitarian zone. We don't know where to go. We stay in the safe area or return to the sea, or where to go. So we found that the safest place to take refuge is the sky.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers have carried out more raids, including on the Nur Shams refugee camp, where at least three Palestinians were killed. The Biden administration has received nearly 500 reports of Israel using U.S.-supplied weapons for attacks that killed and maimed civilians in the Gaza Strip, but it's failed to comply with its own policies requiring swift investigations of such claims. That's according to The Washington Post, which reports some of the cases presented to the State Department likely amount to violations of U.S. and international law. State Department policy requires officials must complete an investigation and recommend action within 2 months of launching an inquiry. Despite that requirement, none of the hundreds of reports has generated an active response, and most cases remain open. Many claims are awaiting a response from the Israeli government, which the State Department consults to verify each case's circumstances. On Wednesday, State Department spokesperson Matt Miller defended the delays, calling it incredibly difficult to determine whether U.S. weapons are being used by Israel to commit war crimes. Miller also criticized Israel for failing to facilitate food and other humanitarian aid delivery to Palestinians in Gaza.
The situation still remains not at a level that we find acceptable. And that's not just about the level of aid that is making it to Gaza, but also the distribution inside Gaza. And we continue to see breakdowns in communication between Israeli forces and UN agencies.
Despite the admission, the U.S. has not taken any action against Israel for blocking the distribution of aid. Elon Musk is appearing at a court hearing in Philadelphia today after District Attorney Larry Krasner sued Musk and his pro-Trump super PAC over his $1 million daily voter giveaway, which Krasner called an illegal lottery scheme. DA Krasner has called for additional court security after Krasner was subjected to anti-Semitic harassment, threats, and doxing on the social media site X, which is owned by Elon Musk. This comes as Wired reports workers who were hired by Musk's America PAC as canvassers were deceived by the contracting firm that hired them. The workers report being flown out to Michigan, driven in the back of a seatless U-Haul, and threatened they would have to cover their own motel bills unless they met their quotas. One contractor told Wired they had no idea they'd been hired to help Donald Trump until after they signed a non-disclosure agreement. The U.S. Supreme Court has allowed Virginia to resume its purge of 1,600 voters from the state's voter rolls just days ahead of the election. The emergency order comes as Virginia officials appeal a decision by a federal judge who ruled the Republican governor Glenn Youngkin's voter roll purge violates the National Voter Registration Act. Youngkin claims he's stopping non-U.S. citizens from voting, but it's statistically extremely rare for non-citizens to cast ballots. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court Tuesday rejected a bid by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to remove his name from ballots in the swing states of Michigan and Wisconsin. The former presidential candidate backed Trump after abandoning his own campaign. RFK Jr. told supporters on a call this week Donald Trump had promised him control of the Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services, including the Centers for Disease Control and National Institutes of Health. But Trump's campaign said confirming those claims would be premature, despite Trump announcing at his Madison Square Garden rally Sunday he would let RFK Jr., quote, go wild on health if Trump is reelected. Kennedy's a prominent anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist. In related news, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said a Trump victory would allow Republicans to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, telling supporters Monday, quote, we want to take a blowtorch to the regulatory state.
No Obamacare.
No Obamacare. Yeah, the ACA is so deeply ingrained. We need massive reform to make this work, and we got a lot of ideas on how to do that.
In other campaign news, Kamala Harris called out comments made by Trump at his Green Bay, Wisconsin rally Wednesday.
I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to protect them from migrants coming in. I'm going to protect them from foreign countries that want to hit us with missiles and lots of other things.
Presidential candidate Harris responded on social media, quote, Donald Trump thinks he should get to make decisions about what you do with your body, whether you like it or not, unquote. An investigation by ProPublica finds at least two people in Texas died after they were denied reproductive health care due to Texas's abortion ban, which bars doctors from ending the heartbeat of a fetus, even when a pregnancy is non-viable and the life of a pregnant person is at risk. In one case, 28-year-old Jocely Barnica was admitted to a Houston hospital as she began to suffer a miscarriage 17 weeks into her pregnancy. For 40 hours, doctors denied her a simple and urgently needed medical procedure to empty her uterus, which would have prevented the infection that ultimately killed her. Barnica died 3 days after her miscarriage. A California judge has sentenced the man who in 2022 broke into Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home and attacked her husband, Paul Pelosi, with a hammer to life in prison. This comes on top of David DePapp's federal sentencing earlier this year to 30 years in prison. DePapp admitted if then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had been present at the time of the attack, he planned to hold her hostage and, quote, break her kneecaps. In Mexico, two journalists were killed in a 24-hour period this week. On Wednesday, entertainment reporter Patricia Ramirez Gonzalez, known as Patty Burnbury, was found dead inside a restaurant she owned in the city of Colima. One day earlier, Mauricio Cruz Solis was shot dead moments after he interviewed the mayor of Uruapan in Michoacán State. The deaths marked the first two journalist murders since President Claudia Sheinbaum took office at the start of this month. Mourners gathered for Cruz Solis's funeral on Wednesday.
This is a situation that must not be repeated. Several journalists here in Uruapan, in Michoacán, in Mexico, have been violently deprived of life. We don't have guarantees for carrying out our work professionally.
The United Nations General Assembly has voted to condemn the United States embargo on Cuba for the 32nd consecutive year. On Wednesday, 187 countries voted in favor of lifting the decades-old sanctions. Only the U.S. and Israel voted against the non-binding resolution. This is Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations.
The U.S. once again has used lies and manipulation to justify the blockade against Cuba, as it also does every year. Its isolation grows and its loss of credibility on the international stage as a result of this criminal policy. What they're doing seems to have no limits. They hold the Cuban government responsible for the suffocation caused by the blockade imposed on our country.
Following Wednesday's vote, Argentina's far-right president Javier Milei fired his foreign minister, replacing her with Argentina's ambassador to Washington. Milei's office said after the reshuffle that Argentina was, quote, categorically opposed to the Cuban dictatorship, unquote. And in Brazil, a trial got underway Wednesday for two former military police officers accused of assassinating the Rio de Janeiro councilwoman Marielle Franco and her driver in a drive-by shooting in March 2018. Rani Lessa and Elcio Queiroz confessed to the murders and signed plea bargains. They still face prison sentences up to 84 years each. Councilmember Franco was a vocal Black LGBTQ rights advocate, a human rights activist who challenged police brutality in one of the world's most notorious police forces. Ahead of the trial, protesters rallied outside the courthouse to demand accountability for Franco's murder and for victims of unsolved crimes in Brazil's marginalized communities. Marielle Franco's mother, Marietti da Silva, joined the protests.
Don't normalize, don't trivialize life, neither my daughters nor any of these children who were also taken. I'm here with other mothers. I'm here with other people who are going through the same pain, and we're going to be together.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we speak to Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. She's accusing Israel of acts of genocide. Stay with us. Devil's Song by Beth Orton. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Israel's deadly siege on northern Gaza has entered a 26th day. Earlier this week, the World Health Organization managed to deliver some medical supplies to the Gamal Adwan Hospital, but earlier today, Israeli fighter jets bombed the hospital's third floor, where the supplies were being stored. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces are continuing to shell Beit Lahia, the scene of multiple massacres this week. On Wednesday, an Israeli attack on a market in Beit Lahia killed at least 10 Palestinians. Earlier in the week, Israel struck a five-story residential building, killing at least 93 people, including 25 children. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, Francesca Albanese, has released a major report accusing Israel of committing genocide. Albanese concludes that Israel's war on Gaza is part of a campaign of, quote, long-term, intentional, systematic, state-organized forced displacement and replacement of the Palestinians, end quote. The report is titled Genocide as Colonial Erasure.
Francesca Albanese is now facing intensifying personal attacks from Israeli and U.S. officials. She was set to brief Congress earlier this week, but the briefing was canceled. On Tuesday, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, wrote on social media, quote, as U.N. Special Rapporteur, Albanese visits New York. I want to reiterate the U.S. belief she's unfit for her role. The United Nations should not tolerate anti-Semitism from a U.N.-affiliated official hired to promote human rights, unquote. On Wednesday, Francesca Albanese spoke at the United Nations and responded to the U.S. attacks.
I have the same shock that you have looking at how the United States is behaving in this context, in the context of the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. I'm not surprised that they attack anyone who speaks to the facts that are, frankly, on our watch in Gaza, and they do that so brutally because they feel called out, because it's not that the United States is simply an observer. The United States is being an enabler in what Israel has been doing.
That was UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese speaking at the United Nations Wednesday. She joins us here in our studio. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we get you to further respond to what the U.S. and Israel are saying, can you lay out the findings of your report?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me. I have to say that this report is the second I write on and I present to the United Nations on the topic of genocide. And it has been very reluctantly that I've taken on the responsibility to be the chronicler of an unfolding genocide in Gaza. In March this year, I concluded that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed at least the three acts of genocide in Gaza, like killing members of the protected group, Palestinians, and inflicting severe bodily and mental harm and creating conditions of life that would lead to the destruction of the group. And the reason why I identified these were not just war crimes or crimes against humanity is because I identified an intent to destroy. And I understand that even in this country, people are quite confused about what is genocidal intent, because it's not a motive. One can have many motives to commit a crime. And I understand genocide is a very insidious one, and it's difficult to identify what's the motive, but this is not about the motives. The intent to commit genocide is the determination to destroy, which is fully evident in especially in the Gaza Strip, as I identified in, as argued in March already. The reason why I continue to write about genocide, and in fact this report walks on the heels of the previous one, is in order to better explain the intent, especially state intent, because there is another misunderstanding that there should be a trial of the alleged perpetrators in order to have to attribute responsibility to a state. No, because not only you have had acts committed that should have been prevented by the, in a rule of law, in a proclaimed rule of law system like Israel, where there is the government, the parliament, the judiciary working as checks and balances, genocide has not only been not prevented, has been enabled through the various organs of the state. And I explain what has happened as of October 7, which has provided the opportunity to escalate violence, to build on the rage and on the fury of many Israelis, turning the soldiers into willful executioners, is that there was already a plan. Hatred, I mean, the Palestinians, like Ilan Pappe says, are victims not of war, but of a political ideology that has been unleashed. Palestinians have always been an unwanted encumbrance in the Israeli mindset because they are an obstacle, both as an identity and as legal status, to the realization of Greater Israel as a state for Jewish Israelis only. Mm-hmm.
So we'll go back to, because I do want to ask about the Israeli state institutions that you name and the branches of the Israeli state that have been involved in forming this state's intent. But if you could elaborate on the point that you make, the difference between intent and motive, and in particular what you say in the report about how it's critical to determine genocidal intent, quote, by way of inference. You know, that's a different phrasing than one has, you know, heard in all of this conversation about genocide so far. If you explain what you mean by that and what such a determination makes possible, so rather than just looking at genocidal intent in other forms, what it means to infer genocidal intent.
So first of all, what constitutes genocide is established by Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, which creates a twofold obligation for member states to prevent genocide, so genocide doesn't have to complete itself. When there is a manifestation of intent, even genocidal intent, there is already an obligation to intervene because the crime is unfolding. And then there is an obligation to punish. How the jurisprudence, especially in after Rwanda and after former Yugoslavia, there have been cases both for criminal proceedings where individual perpetrators have been investigated and tried, and responsibility of the state in the litigated before the International Court of Justice. This is how the jurisprudence on genocide has developed, and this and the intent has been further elaborated upon what the Genocide Convention says. So, and while it might be difficult to have direct intent, meaning to have, it's difficult but not impossible, in fact, to have a state official say, yes, let's go and destroy everyone, although I do believe that there is direct intent in this genocide in Gaza. But the court also established that genocide can be inferred from the scale of the attack on the people, the nature of the attack, the general conduct. And what it says is that normally there should be a holistic approach in order to identify intent, which is exactly what I've done. And indeed, this is why I proposed in this report what I called the triple lens approach. We need to look at the conduct, like at the totality of the conduct, instead of studying with a microscope each and every crime. We need to look at the whole, against the totality of the people, the Palestinians as such, in the totality of the land that Israel has laid as its own by divine design.
No, absolutely. And then if you could, the other precedent you've just spoken about, of course, Rwanda and former Yugoslavia. Another case that you cite in the International Court of Justice is the Gambia versus Myanmar. So how is that comparable to what we see happening in Gaza? Why is that a relevant example and different from both Rwanda and former Yugoslavia? Hmm.
Let me tell you what I see as the major differences in the case of Israel, because that it's a very complex discussion. But in all four cases, there is a toxic combination of hatred, ideological hatred, which has informed political doctrines. And this is true in all the various contexts we have mentioned. The other common element is that there is a combination of crimes. Forced displacement is not an act of genocide per se, but the jurisprudence says that it can contribute to corroborate the intent. But mass killing or mass destruction of property, torture and other crimes against a person, which translate into the infliction of physical and mental harm to the group, not individuals as such, but individuals as part of the group. These are common elements to all genocides. What I find characteristic in this one is, first of all, this is not, I mean, the state of Israel is not Myanmar, and is not Rwanda 30 years ago. This is not war-torn former Yugoslavia. This is a state which has a separation of powers, different organs, as I said, checks and balances. And let me give you a specific example, because you asked me to comment on the state functions. In January this year, the International Court of Justice issued a set of preliminary measures in the context of its identification, before even looking at the merits of the case initiated by South Africa for Israel's alleged breach of the Genocide Convention, which identified the plausibility of risk for the rights protected, for the rights of the Palestinians protected under the Genocide Convention, which means plausibility, it's semantics, but it's plausibility that genocide might be committed against the Palestinians in Gaza. And the provisional measures included an obligation to investigate and prosecute the various cases of incitement, genocidal incitement, that the court had already identified. And it mentions leaders, senior leaders of the Israeli state. Has there been any investigation? Has there been any prosecution? But I'm telling you more. The genocidal statements didn't resonate as shocking in the Israeli public, not only because there was an enormous rage and animosity, of course. I mean, this is understandable that the facts of October 7 were brutal and traumatized the people. But at the same time, hatred against the Palestinians and hate speech, it's not something that started on October 7. I do remember the shock I felt, because no one was reacting. And years ago, there were Israeli ministers talking of freely of killing, justifying the killing of Palestinians' mothers and children because they would turn into terrorists.
Francesca Albanese, talk about the title of your report, Genocide as Colonial Erasure. Mm.
This is another element which I think, and in fact is the most important, where we see the difference between this genocide and others, because there is a settler colonial component. And again, if you look at what the International Court of Justice in July this year concluded, when it decided that when it found that Israel's 57 years of occupation in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem is unlawful and needs to be withdrawn totally and unconditionally as rapidly as possible, which the General Assembly says by September 2025, the court said that it amounts to that the colonies amount to have led to a process of annexation and racial segregation and apartheid. And these are the features of settler